So I think there are some gender differences, and we've seen that in some of the data, right? There's, I think the data that I saw most recently, about 10% higher demand from women for remote work or hybrid work, which makes sense in lots of ways in this, when women are doing a lot of the home care and childcare and need that kind of flexibility.
Welcome to The Ripple Effect, the podcast that takes you on a journey through the minds of Wharton faculty. I'm your host, Dan Loney. And in each episode, we'll be diving deep into the inspiration behind the groundbreaking research that Wharton professors have conducted and exploring how their findings resonate with the world today.
Well, the workplace continues to evolve in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic, and there is obviously a focus on a variety of elements. One being is making the hybrid workplace fair for all involved. There's also a focus on how much a job internationally could mean to someone's career. Pleasure to be joined here in studio by Martine Haas, who's professor of management here at the Wharton School. She is also director of the Lauder Institute for Management and International Studies. Great to see you. Great to have you in the studio
it's
here today.
Good to see you. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Let's start with hybrid, because I think that's one that's on a lot of people's thought process because of how things played out with the pandemic and where we are right now. We know it's probably going to be around here long term. How much, though, do you think around hybrid work is still to be determined from where we are right now?
Yeah, it's feeling pretty kind of settled in some ways for a lot of companies, in the sense of we're kind of relieved. It's kind of working. We seem to be in decent shape, right? Which, you know, is good, but it also means we need to be careful about becoming complacent, I think, because there's definitely, you know, aspects of it that can use continuous kind of focus and maybe some tweaking and maybe some improvements, right? So we shouldn't get too kind of, you know, too settled in this. But there's no question it's going to be around for a while in lots of ways. There's lots of things about it that are good, right? And it's kind of in many ways a good compromise between lots of things that employees want and have wanted for a long time, right? More flexibility, less commuting, more autonomy, right? And things that companies want and need in terms of having people in the office at least some of the time, right? So it seems to be a pretty good balance, but there's a lot of issues that arise that still that need to be continually kind of worked through.
And it seems like the and it's not every company, but the mindset of certain C-suite executives is very much anti-hybrid work or remote work, and others seems to be, okay, I understand it's a component that we're going to need. And I don't know if it's a generational component or what we're seeing play out here, but it is unique that you hear commentary from some executives and they are very much anti-hybrid work.
Yeah, no, it's definitely true. They have serious concerns about it. And that, you know, so it adds up to, if you're going to need to have it because your talent wants it and your talent has a lot of power in the labor market, then as managers, you've got to figure out how to make sure that that is going to still meet the organization's needs, right? And so how to put in place kinds of systems and processes that are going to help it to work smoothly for everybody, right? And there's a whole set of challenges associated with that I think we still really kind of, you know, there's been a lot of just let's carry over what we were doing before and hopefully it applies pretty well for hybrid work. But it may be that we need to really kind of think much more carefully about how we design our onboarding processes, our mentoring processes, our talent development and sort of skills training kind of processes to make sure that people can really are really equipped and really have the skills that they need.
And I guess it's going to be interesting to see play out in the months and years ahead as to who the people are within the workforce that are majority going to be the people that are ending up working hybrid. Obviously, as you said before, there's a component of lifestyle and things outside of work that are allowing hybrid work to be a good combination. But whether or not it is men or women that see this opportunity as being more applicable to what they want to have in their careers.
Yeah, so I think there are some gender differences, and we've seen that in some of the data, right? There's, I think the data that I saw most recently, about 10% higher demand from women for remote work or hybrid work, which makes sense in lots of ways in this, when women are doing a lot of the home care and childcare and need that kind of flexibility. But it's also very much a kind of time of your life kind of thing. And that really, you know, is a really big deal that I think we've come to realize a bit more recently. So for younger younger people, more junior in their careers, and not, don't necessarily have families and that kind of need that kind of flexibility at that point in their careers, it makes a lot of sense. And I think people have, you know, those young people who kind of were like, oh, it's going to be great to be on a beach somewhere. No, they've kind of realized, right? Actually, there's a lot of value that they get from being in the workplace. And if they're not there, they're going to miss out on some stuff they really need, like those mentoring kind of and networking kind of connections. But then, you know, midlife, when people have families, a lot of other demands, it can, you know, people want more flexibility. And later in life, I suspect it probably diverges a little bit. Some people really like being in the office, some people not so much, and there's maybe just more individual differences.
I guess we also have to look at it from the perspective of a person's career and where that path is going to go. And if you are somebody that is working hybrid, what potential impact that might have if you are not in the office 5 days a week, but you're, you know, working remotely 2 or 3 days a week.
Yeah, so for sure. And, you know, I think as people's careers evolve, there's so many good reasons why people want that flexibility. They want to be hybrid or they want to be remote, that we should respect. They're really important, right, in terms of the rest of your life, right, and your ability to manage the rest of your life. But I think it's really important to recognize that it does come with some disadvantages and just be conscious of those. Doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, right? But it does mean that you are less visible to possibly your manager who's in the office more than you are, maybe to everybody else on your team, right? They just don't quite know if you're there all the time or working as hard as you should be. You don't necessarily have the access to resources that people have when they're in the office more of the time. And over time, you know, it's probably fine in the short term, right? But over time, that might mean maybe you're not really quite in the loops that you need to be in terms of information. Maybe you're not doing your job quite as well, or maybe you are and people just don't see it, right? And maybe you don't get that promotion as fast as you might otherwise, or whatever. You don't get the opportunities that you might otherwise. So again, you can make that decision for yourself, just make it consciously, right, that you're making that trade-off. And you know, and I think managers have to really be conscious of that too and try to make sure that they're being fair and they're not disadvantaging people who are taking advantage of work policies that they've put in place and have agreed they're okay to have in place.
Right? Well, and I guess it becomes even more of a focus for women because there are still elements of the workforce that disadvantage women compared to men. So they, as you said, have to have that kind of conscious understanding of the impacts that could come along in the terms of where they want to take their careers.
Yeah. And so I think for women, you know, I call this a double disadvantage, right? We know there can be a remote work penalty for anybody who's kind of not in the office so much, especially when other people are in the office more, right? Yeah. If you are a woman in a male-dominated industry or workplace, you know, you automatically probably have a bit of a disadvantage from that. And there's a lot of research showing that in different ways. You put together the two disadvantages and you have a bit of a, you know, potential at least for a double disadvantage, right? You're both remote and you're maybe a bit more marginalized in the first place, maybe a little bit less likely to be listened to when you speak, maybe a little bit less likely to be given the best opportunities or hooked up with the most senior male mentors or whatever it might be. And so again, over time, that double disadvantage could be a disadvantage. It could be a substantial disadvantage for your career, right? And again, women may choose to make that decision deliberately and consciously and understand that and still have really good reasons for doing it.
Right.
But it's important to be aware of it. And it's also, I think, worth noting, it's not just women. I mean, I think it's anybody who might be or feel marginalized in the workplace in the first place.
Right.
Could be people of color, could be people who are non-dominant language speakers, right? Not English speakers in an English-speaking company. Just, you can get that double disadvantage in other ways, right? It's just if you're already a little bit marginal and then you're not in the office as much, those things can compound. And from a career point of view, you should be aware of that.
Well, and off of that, because there's also been the conversation as hybrid work has kind of developed, of kind of segmenting your day. Like, you may not be anymore traditionally 9 to 5 or 8 to 4, but those hours may be spread out over a 12-hour window. And it makes you wonder whether or not the people who may end up being in that double disadvantage feel like they have to work a longer day in order to make up for that presence of not being there.
Yeah, and we know that has happened. It happened to a lot of us during the pandemic, and you know, hopefully it's eased up for a lot of us. But that sort of sense of being on call the whole time is an unfortunate byproduct, I think, of kind of relying so heavily on technology and not being in the office with clearer work hours all the time. So yeah, it's something to look at, but it's also important for people who are working from home, I think, to recognize that managers don't see them all the time during the workday. So it's kind of, they don't know that they're doing their work during all the workday. So sort of trying to align their hours with the manager's hours in some ways is desirable. And the manager should not take too much advantage of that and be trying to, you know, get people to work, you know, 12-hour, 15-hour days.
Does technology hopefully fill in maybe some of those gaps then in those circumstances? I mean, being able to have a Zoom call with your coworkers, or does it not do enough, do you think?
I mean, technology, you know, is a double-edged sword, right? It's great for a lot of these things. It wouldn't be possible to be doing hybrid work if we didn't have the technologies that we got used to during the pandemic. It would just not have happened in the same way, certainly not as fast, in terms of being able to do Zoom calls and being online all the time, just, you know, and easily accessible. Technology has its disadvantages too, right? You don't get the real kind of cues that you get from being with somebody face-to-face. You don't get those side conversations that you have when you're in the workplace. So it's too easy to think it's a perfect substitute. And we all know it isn't. We also all know that there's too many Zoom meetings.
That's right. Exactly right. Right. We rely on that technology too much.
A little too much.
You have also done research looking at the career, but the potential of the benefits or impacts of going international, of getting a job offer some other place in the world or working for your company in another office. Take us into a deeper dive on how that is impacting the dynamic of career right now.
Yeah, so I've done a recent study with my co-authors, Matthew Bidwell, who's a colleague of mine here at Wharton, and Isabel Fernandez Mateo, who's at London Business School, and Giovanna Capone, who's in the Netherlands. And, you know, we took this big data set of alums, MBA alums from one of the leading European business schools who tend to be super international. And we looked at their careers over time and how their international moves affect their compensation, right? Which turns out, you know, there's a lot of research on how international moves might affect your opportunities, but actually they don't usually look at compensation. And so we were really interested to understand what the effects are on pay. And we found some really interesting things, which are kind of, you know, there's research that says, you know, the stuff is likely to be negative. You move internationally and you kind of lose opportunities, you lose your local networks. It's hard to come back, it's hard to resettle and all that stuff. Maybe it's bad. There's other research that says maybe it's good, right? Because you're gaining all these international skills and maybe somebody's going to pay you more for them, right? Mm-hmm. We didn't really know. What we found in the study, and it's a pretty comprehensive and kind of carefully done study, is that when people who have moved once or twice, and this is post MBA careers, so they're knowledge workers, they're in business careers, right? If they've moved once or twice, it's actually negatively associated with their pay, in the sense that their pay doesn't grow as fast, right, as people who haven't moved internationally. And we were a little surprised. This is a negative effect, right? Then we find on top of that, which is kind of even more surprising, is there are a set of people for whom these international moves are really beneficial, but they're people that we call super globals. They're people who have moved internationally many, many times. In our study, it's four or more times since their MBA. And those people get a substantial pay premium. So, you know, from a career point of view, I think, you know, international moves can have positive implications in all sorts of ways. Yeah. From a pure pay point of view, first couple of moves don't seem to have, you know, you're not doing them necessarily because they're going to pay you the most.
Sure.
You may be doing them for other really good reasons, right? There are these people who move a ton, super globals, who, you know, are at the very elite kind of end of the international employment spectrum, and they're making a lot of money from it.
Are those people that end up having all of those experiences and maybe they are more relied upon within the corporate kind of environment of a company? They've seen more components of the company, and therefore they can bring more to the table?
Yeah, I think that's right. So, I mean, our sense is that, and we did a lot of interviews trying to understand exactly who the super globals are, what their careers look like, why they're so valuable. It is the case that, you know, some companies really need people who have substantial international experience, right, because of the kind of work they do. These folks have built a really unique set of skills and perspectives and sort of adaptability, and they can cope in many different environments. They can cope with a lot of different unexpected events, right? They've often demonstrated that through the way they've worked internationally. And then on top of that, these people are rare, right? So there's not that many people you can find who are going to be able to run that, you know, super international division out there. Yeah. So once you as an employer, you know, as somebody, you know, in a career where you've moved multiple times, you not only have the set of skills, but you're also really rare in the workplace. And so you're not, you know, going to get employed for some job that doesn't value that, But for the jobs that do really value that, you can command a premium. And that's what we see in this data.
And again, it probably falls back into that category of being the personal decision, the understanding of what the components are of that career that really have to be thought about in order to kind of take that leap.
Yeah, that's right. And in some ways, maybe that connects back to our kind of hybrid work conversation is it's just about being conscious of the choices that you're making, right? And what we do find, especially for people, which will be more people than the super globals, right, the people who are thinking about moving once or twice internationally in their careers, it's about being conscious of the trade-offs you're making, right? And those can be really good trade-offs or really, you know, valid trade-offs to make, right? Are you moving because you personally value this personal enrichment, right? You love spending time, not just traveling, but spending serious time in different countries, right? And having different experiences and having adventures. And you really want to learn from that. Are you moving because there are fabulous professional opportunities for growth that are going to kind of expose you to, you know, maybe you get to run your own division or do something that you wouldn't have been able to do domestically? And do you really want to maximize your pay? And the chances that those things all go together at least in the first, you know, move or two when you're relatively junior in your career are not super likely. You're probably going to make trade-offs. Again, just recognize that that's the trade-off that you're making and it's totally valid, right? But don't assume that these things are necessarily all going to align and work in your favor.
So as you say that, does there seemingly come a point in that process where people kind of make that decision that, okay, I'm going to kind of be that super global or maybe I'm not going to be. And that's kind of the, you know, whether there's a moment in time where that kind of transitions and you go one way or the other.
Yeah, I think there probably is for a lot of people. I mean, as somebody who's moved internationally, as have my co-authors in the study a lot, you know, I think usually at some point you get to a point where most people get to a point where they've kind of moved enough and kind of want to settle at least for a substantial period of time. There are a small number of people who just love it and thrive and do extremely well and keep having these kind of international opportunities that lead them to move. But it is interesting, I think, in the sense of kind of as you're thinking about the skills that you want to develop and what you're trying to get out of these different opportunities, you know, once you're somewhere you kind of think is maybe the longer term place you want to stay, you're going to be trying to develop, you know, really local networks and understanding and language and really settle, right? But if you think you're going to keep moving, that kind of local knowledge is important. It's probably going to be important for your longer term jobs too, but you're going to need a different set of skills on top of that, right? Adaptability and flexibility and kind of open-mindedness and global mindset. So you're going to kind of be adding a different layer because you think you're going to keep moving.
Martine, great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you too, Dan.
Thank you. Martine Haas, management professor here at the Wharton School and director of the Lauder Institute.
Thank you for listening to The Ripple Effect. We hope you found this episode informative and engaging. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review so that we can continue to bring you the best insight from the Wharton School.